So hello, everyone. This is Ed Rogoff again. I'm very happy to welcome John Haworth as a guest to give you additional information on important topics relative to starting a nonprofit. John has had an incredible career on multiple sides of giving money, spending money, running major institutions. And I have to say that in my experience, I've not met somebody who sort of sees the overall picture of the nonprofit world as thoughtfully and comprehensively as John does. So I'm very happy that he's giving us some time. I would ask urge you to pay attention to what he has. This is really a person with great wisdom on this topic. So John, maybe you can tell people about your career, how you got into the nonprofit, arts world, government side, museums, et cetera. So, you know, how did you get started with this?
Well, I actually got my start by doing an internship through the National Endowment for the Arts, and I was assigned to my home state working with the Oklahoma Arts and Humanities Council at the time. This is many decades ago. And that journey led me to having a career in government arts agencies, state arts agencies. So I had the opportunity to work in Arizona and also in New York State. And what was interesting, because when I started my career, now state arts agencies are primarily funding and policy driven state agencies. But in the earlier days of the state arts agency movement, it was very programmatic focused. So we were actually organizing touring programs, and with that came we were in a relatively new area in rural Arizona, trying to teach organizations, like, what did you need to do to present a performance, or what do you need to do to present an exhibition? So I worked a lot with presenting organizations, producing organizations, and the like. Later, fast forward, I had a career at both the New York State Council on the Arts and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. So I know the kind of the track of funding and so forth from my experience in New York. But in the mid 1990s, I was offered an incredible opportunity to join the Smithsonian and become the director of the National Museum of the American Indians branch in New York City, based in Lower Manhattan. So that was a really wonderful experience for me. But along the way, and germane to your wonderful book, because I think you're really posing some very important questions, Ed, which is like, well, how do you do this work, and how do you get started, and what's the recipe for making a successful organization? And I've dealt with that question in a variety of ways with both big and small cultural organizations, and in my work serving on the boards of directors. I usually get tapped to either chair or work on the strategic planning committees of national and local organizations. So I've had the great opportunity of working with Americans for the Arts on their strategic plan. I was tapped within the National Museum of the American Indian and co-chaired the just most recently published strategic plan that the National Museum of the American Indian did before I retired from that institution in 2017. So taking all of this, I'm on an adjunct faculty member at New York University, and planning is very much something that the students in the museum world are very, very interested in learning the tools of the trade there. And one thing that I've learned, and I think your book really really addresses this in a very specific and quite tangible way. And that's one reason I have like such high regard for the work that you've been doing many years, because I think you've blended a kind of spirit of being an entrepreneurial and then really how do we get it done, and how do we have the operational structures, how do we have the programmatic structures, how do we have the governance structures to really make something really work and have a possibility. And what I've learned, the one major takeaway from that, I think from whatever comments I give you today, is that it's not rocket science, but you have to really think about the different key areas of work that any organization has to accomplish. And I look at it, I look at organizations through the lens of four different areas. Number one, the sort of mission-driven or programmatic aspects of an organization. And this could apply to whether it's a cultural organization or an upstart business or a healthcare organization or a service organization or educational institution. It's all really the same. That's been my experience throughout my career. So the first kind of big bucket of work is really looking at the programmatic dynamics of an organization. And then you kind of have to look at the operational dynamics. Is it able, will the operation support the mission and support the programmatic aspects of what an organization aspires to do? And the third area is, of course, in the resource area, having ample resources, both human resources and financial ones, and real estate and other things, and making sure that everything is really in sync in that area of the organization's work. And then the fourth bucket, and only these four, are all of the what I call community relations, civic engagement, all of that, audience development, however you frame it, but anything that is in the community realm of an organization's work. And what I think it's very important, and I think your book really calls this out, is that before you even get started putting pencil to paper on this, is you got to really think out, what the hell are we trying to accomplish by having this organization? Is it necessary? You know, I think that not all organizations, and certainly in this pandemic, not all nonprofit organizations or educational institutions are going to make it. And so basically, I think why reading your good words of thinking about bankable business plans of something that's very specific, something that's very tangible, something that's very time-based, something that really engages a team of people to move things forward in a very deliberate and intentional way. So back to my four areas of programmatic, operational, resources, and community, I always look at these, and what I found, my observation and analysis over the years has been, when there is great equilibrium in an organization, and where the operational and the resource side of the house is in full support and in sync, if you will, with the programmatic, it's then and only then that an organization can figure out the step-by-step what to do on this. And I also have this observation, why I applaud the good work that you've done in your writing and also in your career, frankly, over the years, has been that it is spot on saying, this is what we can accomplish with these resources, with this structure, and supporting this mission. So you're really like, and then putting it in a timetable that makes sense. I've also found that I basically like to see big changes, like let's shake things up and let's rethink our mission, let's rethink everything, everything's on the table. But I'm also a pragmatist, because I think that there is making incremental bite-sized piece improvements along the way, and figuring out, like, if you look at even one functional area in the operational, like looking at, oh, let's have better personnel policies, or let's have better recruitment policies. We want to have a diverse workforce. We want to, like, have the connections with educational institutions. Well, that's all fine and good, but figuring out the pathway of how you do that and what are the relationships that need to be put in place and what are the procedures that need to be put in place. So that can be overwhelming. And that's why I really advocate fiercely for a simplified approach. I'll also say this, Ed, I think there's a lot of people out there in the world. I've done a fair amount of consulting work in my career, proud of it, happy to do it. But I also think there's a lot of people that are hanging out the consultant shingle and say, I'm here to solve all your problems. And I think that what your good advice that you're giving your readers is very much on think this through very carefully. It's okay to have someone help you. It's okay to hire a consultant. It's okay to tap someone on a board member or someone that has this skill set on the staff or a volunteer. But basically, it becomes one of these of looking in the mirror and really figuring it out and how you connect those four areas and make them really in sync. And so it really works together. So that's kind of my approach on this. I do think, and one thing that we share is that our work and our careers have been very much in the pragmatic, road tested, this is how we're going to proceed. And I think that that's a very important way. I also want to, I had the great opportunity. I went to the Columbia Business School. I started out in the Institute for Not-for-Profit Management, and then I did the management degree program for executives and then earned an MBA through it. And I found that the best advice, the most strategic thinking, professors that I had were very specific about their functional areas. And my job as a student and then later as a practitioner of this work is to really draw from all of that wisdom, from all of that, all of the reading and the functional areas and looking at, but then bringing them to life in terms of a strategic process. And I think that that's the real key to success in this.
Wow. When you started running the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian, you became part of a vast bureaucracy, yes. Many organizations, many arts organizations, et cetera, are in a sense, parts of vast other organizations. What did you find became the sort of shocking part to you that you felt you needed to adjust to in becoming part of this, incredible institution that had history, that had ways of doing business, that had government funding, with all the pluses and minuses that brought? What did you find the adjustment was for you?
Well, there was something very interesting in the birth of the National Museum of the American Indian, which was created by a bipartisan across the aisle agreement in 1989 of the Congress and signed by the president. And it was very much in creating this institution, but there was very much something on the table, front and center, which is, I think, very new for the Smithsonian, which had been largely and historically a government museum. It's on the National Mall. It's very focused in Washington, D.C. And one of the things that was really part of the early DNA of the National Museum of the American Indian was there was a demand that there had to be a lot of private sector funding on the table. Now, this is before many of the Indian tribes had developed gaming or mineral rights or sources, economic resources, where they could be in a position to give philanthropically to an institution like the National Museum of the American Indian. But the thing that was rather magical about the whole, and I just had a wonderful experience and great career at the Smithsonian and with NMAI. But one thing that we had at the top of that organization, we had a very dynamic external focused communicator and excellent fundraiser in the person of Rick West, who was the founding director of NMAI. But what he had that made it work so that he could have this external platform and really articulate the vision was a backup of a very strong day-to-day senior operational manager, Doug Evelyn, who was my boss actually for a large part of my career at the Indian Museum. And they worked in such harmony and partnership to make things work. And there were very complicated times, like there were big construction demands and a building because we built two brand new facilities, one on the National Mall and then the Collection Cultural Resource Facility in Suitland, Maryland. And at the same time, we're developing actually the third leg of this tricycle, third wheel of the tricycle was the facility that I managed in Lower Manhattan. And that was part of I won't go into all the details on it in this conversation today, but that was the other thing of having a real strong and vibrant presence of having a museum in a city. New York City is such a museum town. And so competitive and so extraordinary. So to really have that institution have any public visibility and have the respect and getting and developing the resources that it needed from the private sector, from individuals, from foundations, from corporations, and then also bringing the community along. And I think actually in the whole nonprofit governance of the last, say, 15 years or so, I think that there's been a lot of headway made in developing and knowing how do we work best with communities. And right now, in the context of both the pandemic and some of the issues, political issues that are on the table, certainly on racial justice issues, is the realization that community relations and being very intentional about how we define community, how we work community, that is a key strategic variable for the success to define the success of any organization. Well, in the case of the National Museum of the American Indian, there was both, and this is speaks directly to the strategic planning piece of this, there was the local in the Lower Manhattan neighborhood, working with the business improvement districts, working with the mayor's office, working with the office of different offices, cultural offices, different public agencies and elected officials. But in the larger scheme of things, there was also a national, even international community because it was a hemispheric institution. So partly how our leader, Rick West, developed this was very much he was determined that having the input from Native American communities from around the hemisphere was the heart and soul of this institution. Now, that is a tall order because how do you go about doing it and how do you get the right training and the right people in the room to really do this kind of important and community-based outreach work? And how do you work in all the political and programmatic and historical terms of a very large and important Native American community and indigenous community in Central and South America? So that was really a tall challenge for the institution. Now, earlier you mentioned about, you used the word bureaucracy. And I think that in any governmental organization, but also any large nonprofit or large corporate environment, there is going to be a lot of the operational bureaucracy, if you will. There's a lot to go through. There's procedures to develop. There's rules to follow. There's like figuring out all of those things. And I think that the Smithsonian, because it has, you know, it's right in the backyard of Congress. It's just right there. And, you know, it's in a very governmental city. So Washington, D.C., there's always the feedback loop, if you will, of what elected leaders from all over the country might, their opinion of it, because we were part of the Department of the Interior. We had, so appropriation issues for the Smithsonian were very, very important. And I remember because during the course of my career, and I think the listeners that are tuning into this understand and remember full well, at least anybody over 30 remembers full well the government shutdowns and what was caused in that. So that were there were changes and bureaucratic and political challenges along the way. And I think that that becomes, I really embrace those challenges because in a kind of fundamental way, when we look at an organization and say, okay, how are we going to plot its course strategically? How are we going to move things forward? You have to look at, as I focused a little bit in my comments today, you have to focus on these internal the resources, the operational, but you also have to focus on external variables. And I think that that intersection of the externals and the internals is very much key to a solid, formidable strategic planning process. You have to understand those external variables and then be selective. It's not just cherry picking. It's really looking squarely at what the challenges are, but looking at those external variables and say, okay, how are we going to deal with this? And how are we going to deal with, there's going to be people that will have opinions, good and bad, about our institution and what we're doing. There will be funders and foundation executives and corporations and board members who will have opinions of saying, well, you should do it this way, or you should do it that way, or you should do it. So having a clarity and a real fix about what is the pathway that is going to lead us forward. Now, along the way, in any strategic plan, there are going to be changing dynamics. And I think one of the things in my career, earlier in my career, people often spoke about, professionals, very strong people, would talk about, we've got to do a five-year plan for the institution. And part of the development of a written planning document, that becomes also a very important tool for fundraising and development work, a tool for community relations work, a tool for setting the stage for a conversation, a serious conversation, a conversation that moves things forward with elected officials and with civic leaders and with other, and in our case, Native American leaders around the country. So how did that match up with what their aims were? Like, for example, in today's world, and here we are, dealing with a health crisis and dealing with a lot of changes in the society, but there are foundation executives and civic leaders stepping up to the platform to say, we need to pay more attention to this issue or that issue. We need to pay more attention to social justice issues. We need to pay more attention to racial equity and diversity issues. We need to pay more attention to how are we going to physically serve the audiences in an environment where we're having to cut back on the audience participation level. What is our presence online? So there are many complicated variables. And I think one of the things over the years at the Smithsonian itself faced a lot of senior management challenges, faced a lot of governmental funding challenges, faced several governance challenges. There were some really serious ethical issues about funders who wanted to call the tune and say, I'm going to give you the money, but here's the condition of it. How do you deal with these variables from an ethical and sort of like straightforward way, like, how are we going to do it? And there were even large challenges. I think that the existence of the African American History and Cultural Museum, which is a very prominent and very successful institution, and the director of that institution, Lonnie Bunch, was then tapped to be the head of the Smithsonian, to be the secretary of the Smithsonian. I think that actually the African American History and Cultural Museum actually took a lot, they learned a lot about the ground that had been covered by the National Museum of the American Indian. But both of those institutions together were actually in conversation, if you will, in debate, if you will, with the Smithsonian's American History Museum. So one of the strategic challenges for the institution is, just because there's a Native American museum or an African American museum on our National Mall, does not take the American History Museum or the Air and Space Museum or any other museum off the hook in terms of addressing the interest of looking at a discourse that's informed by African Americans or Native Americans. So those are some of the kind of strategic challenges that I think any you know, head of the Smithsonian or the senior management. And along the way, there were a couple of big exhibits along the way that really had some public controversy to them. And so how do you like get through those periods strategically? It's not easy.
One question, you referred to the issue of raising private money, that was a mandate for the museum to seek out and raise private funds. I know, having been parts of big institutions, you know, very often donors, prospective donors say, well, you know, you're part of the government. They got all the money in the world. Why do you need money from me? Or even if you're, got a very well-known donor, you're going to say, well, why are you looking for a gift from me? Because, this family has so much money, go to them. Did that become a challenge to raise private funds?
Well, it was a huge challenge, and I'll address it in two ways. Number one, because of the parallel success of some of the gaming tribes that were involved in Indian gaming. And basically, we got seven-figure gifts from three of the tribes that really made it possible to build the museum on the National Mall. And without that money, arguably, we wouldn't have nearly the success that we had. So there was a perception in some quarters that, wait a minute, real misperception that Native Americans are so wealthy, they can support this, and why do you need support from any other sector? Just let the gaming tribes take care of it. Well, this is a fallacy, because gaming has benefited many tribes, but it has not benefited many tribes. And so there's all of that. Another part of this was certainly, I think that our leadership at the National Museum of the American Indian did some really terrific work with the foundation world and even with some of the corporations. We got significant Merrill Lynch support, significant Bank of America support. There was significant corporate support on the table. However, this is in the context of a really changing environment within the corporate funding world, and a lot of critiques of some companies, as is well reported, taking money, the issues of the last year in particular, the issues faced by the Whitney Museum and the Guggenheim of taking money from major pharmaceutical companies and opioids, in dealing with, should we take money from big tobacco or the pharmaceutical industry or whatever. So there's a lot of challenges in editorial pages, in foundation boardrooms and foundation executives, there's a lot of, in the Chronicle of Philanthropy, there's a lot of challenges to what is legitimate money to raise. But all that aside, I think this is why being rock solid on a written strategic plan gives you the documentation, gives you the data that is embedded in that, that is then articulated to a larger audience that helps you move this forward. So no matter how the winds are blowing outside of the organization, it's still important to be very grounded in what is it that we want to accomplish and how are we going to get there. So I think that's been really one of the challenges. But I think you also said something else, Ed, that's very important and really hits home to my experience, and that is very much I was faced with, well, why should any private sector, individual or corporation support an institution that is part of the Smithsonian because it receives a large amount of money from the American people through the government. So there is a allocation process and there's money that is from government sources. But I also believe that there are funders that understand that there are the institutions within the Smithsonian can accomplish very unique and very important things that are good for the whole society. So I think that is the kind of rhyme and reason. And of course, one of the challenges that an institution like the Smithsonian, there's been debates over the years about, well, should the Smithsonian charge admission for the public to come to the museum? And basically, the Smithsonian has held the view, there's one exception to this, but they have held the view that the access to the American people and to the world to be able to come to the museums for no cost is very much, no admission, is very important to, this is as important as national parks, it's as important as our public library system. You know, all of these things are challenged, like how do you, you know, all the questions of how do you pay for it. But not having that earned revenue puts the Smithsonian in a different and more complicated corner than I would say arguably other institutions that do charge an admission have. I mean, one of the things in New York City with so many school districts that just have no money for cultural activities or field trips, having an institution that provided was first come, first serve, or working with different classrooms, but an educational audience, having the young people come to the institution in school groups, but having them be able to have a free admission for their class was very important. Now, what we did as a strategic variable, we looked at the National Museum of the American Indian, we looked very much at, well, let's look at our profile educationally and what are the sort of grade levels, what are we trying to really have a real say in? And we looked at it and we thought, okay, we do not have the capacity or the resources to make the huge changes in curriculum around the country. We just didn't have those kind of, we could imagine them, but we didn't have them practically, we couldn't do it. However, from a policy perspective, it was very important that we said, okay, here's some guidance on, and we had developed the institution developed in the last 7 or 8 years, something called the National Education Initiative. And it's been very important and looking at, in particular, looking specifically at the New York State curriculum and what is in the state curriculum that's correct, what is in the curriculum that a museum can have a voice and be, can help illuminate some of the issues that our teachers are working hard to teach our young people, and at what are the grade levels where that makes the most, the best and most optimal difference in the entire curriculum. So those are kind of, you know, variables that play into it, and you can imagine the kind of voices that you need in the room to really tackle an area that has a lot of depth and technical issues to resolve, to be able to then have the program, you know.
Yes, fantastic. You know, at the beginning of this conversation, I set the bar high. And I think anyone who's starting out in this field can aspire to say, I want to get to the point of being as sophisticated in my understanding of the issues and the interaction of the issues that you have.
Oh, and thank you.
It's fantastic. So I think listening to you is a wonderful thing that I can offer my readers. I'm very thankful to you for making the time and being as candid and open about some of the issues that you've dealt with in your career. So, you know, thank you very, very much.
Well, you've developed an incredible book, so.
Thank you so much. Don't be surprised if you get a second, third request for the.
Oh, that's great. Well, I appreciate it. What an honor to speak with you this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.